drops. Across the street, a long-legged woman in tight jeans and excellent black boots had climbed out of the other cab. This woman was Chip's little sister, Denise, that is, was the only attractive young woman on the planet whom he was neither permitted nor inclined to feast his eyes on and imagine having sex with, seemed to him just the latest unfairness in a long morning of unfairnesses. Denise was carrying a black umbrella, a cone of flowers, and a pastry box tied with twine. She picked her way through the pools and rapids on the pavement and joined Chip beneath the marquee. "Listen," Chip said with a nervous smile, not looking at her, "I need to ask you a big favor. I need you to hold the fort for me here while I find Eden and get my script back. There's a major, quick set of corrections I have to make." As if he were a caddy or a servant, Denise handed him her umbrella and brushed water and grit from the ankles of her jeans. Denise had her mother's dark hair and pale complexion and her father's intimidating air of moral authority. She was the one who'd instructed Chip to invite his parents to stop and have lunch in New York today. She'd sounded like the World Bank dictating terms to a Latin debtor state because, unfortunately, Chip owed her some money. He owed her whatever $10,000 and $5,500 and $4,000 and $1,000 added up to. "See," he explained, "Eden wants to read the script this afternoon sometime, and financially, obviously, it's critical that we..." "You can't leave now," Denise said. "It'll take me an hour," Chip said. "An hour and a half at most." "Is Julia here?" "No, she left. She said hello and left."
"You broke up?"
"I don't know. She's gotten herself medicated, and I don't even trust..."
"Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Are you wanting to go to Eden's or chasing Julia?"
Chip touched the rivet in his left ear. 90% going to Eden's."
"Oh, Chip."
"No, but listen," he said. "She's using the word health like it has some kind of absolute, timeless meaning."
"This is Julia?"
"She takes pills for 3 months. The pills make her unbelievably obtuse, and the obtuseness then defines itself as mental health. It's like blindness defining itself as vision. Now that I'm blind, I can see there's nothing to see." Denise sighed and let her cone of flowers droop to the sidewalk.
"What are you saying? You want to follow her and take away her medicine?"
"I'm saying the structure of the entire culture is flawed," Chip said. "I'm saying the bureaucracy has arrogated the right to define certain states of mind as diseased. A lack of desire to spend money becomes a symptom of disease that requires expensive medication, which medication then destroys the libido, in other words, destroys the appetite for the one pleasure in life that's free, which means the person has to spend even more money on compensatory pleasures. The very definition of mental health is the ability to participate in the consumer economy. When you buy into therapy, you're buying into buying, and I'm saying that I personally am losing the battle with a commercialized, medicalized, totalitarian modernity right this instant." Denise closed one eye and opened the other very wide. Her open eye was like nearly black balsamic vinegar beading on white china.
"If I grant that these are interesting issues," she said, "will you stop talking about them and come upstairs with me?"
Chip shook his head. "There's a poached salmon in the fridge, a creme fraiche with sorrel, a salad with green beans and hazelnuts. You'll see the wine and the baguette and the butter. It's good fresh butter from Vermont."
"Has it occurred to you that Dad is sick?"
"An hour is all it's going to take. Hour and a half at most."
"I said, has it occurred to you that Dad is sick?"
Chip had a vision of his father trembling and pleading in the doorway. To block it out, he tried to summon up an image of sex with Julia, with the azure-haired stranger, with Ruthie, with anyone. But all he could picture was a vengeful, fury-like horde of disembodied breasts. "The faster I get to Eden's and make those corrections," he said, "the sooner I'll be back, if you really want to help me." An available cab was coming down the street. He made the mistake of looking at it, and Denise misunderstood him.
"I can't give you any more money," she said.
He recoiled as if she'd spat on him. "Jesus, Denise, I'd like to, but I can't. I wasn't asking you for money. Because where does it end?" He turned on his heel and walked into the downpour and marched toward University Place, smiling with rage. He was ankle-deep in a boiling, gray, sidewalk-shaped lake. He was clutching Denise's umbrella in his fist without opening it. And still it seemed unfair to him. It seemed not his fault that he was getting drenched. Until recently, and without ever giving the matter much thought, Chip had believed that it was possible to be successful in America without making lots of money. He'd always been a good student, and from an early age he'd proved unfit for any form of economic activity except buying things. This he could do. And so he'd chosen to pursue a life of the mind. Since Alfred had once mildly but unforgettably remarked that he didn't see the point of literary theory, and since Enid, in the florid biweekly letters by means of which she saved many dollars on long-distance dialing, had regularly begged Chip to abandon his pursuit of an impractical doctorate in the humanities, "I see your old science fair trophies," she wrote, "and I think of what an able young man like you could be giving back to society as a medical doctor. But then, you see, Dad and I always hoped we'd raise children who thought of others, not just themselves." Chip had had plenty of incentives to work hard and prove his parents wrong. By getting out of bed much earlier than his grad school classmates, who slept off their Gauloise hangovers until noon or 1 o'clock, he'd piled up the prizes and fellowships and grants that were the coin of the academic realm. For the first 15 years of his adult life, his only experience with failure had come second-hand. His girlfriend in college, and long after, Tori Timmelman, was a feminist theorist who'd become so enraged with the patriarchal system of accreditation and its phallometric yardsticks of achievement that she refused, or was unable, to finish her dissertation. Chip had grown up listening to his father pontificate on the topics of men's work and women's work and the importance of maintaining the distinction. In a spirit of correction, he stuck with Tori for nearly a decade. He did all the laundry, and most of the cleaning, and cooking, and cat care in the little apartment that he and Tori shared. He read secondary literature for Tori and helped her outline and re-outline the chapters of her thesis that she was too throttled by rage to write. Not until D. College had offered him a 5-year tenure-track appointment, while Tori, still minus a degree, took a 2-year non-renewable job at an agriculture school in Texas, did he fully exhaust his supply of male guilt and move on. He arrived at D, then, as an eligible and well-published 33-year-old to whom the college's provost, Jim Leviton, had all but guaranteed lifelong employment. Within a semester, he was sleeping with the young historian Ruthie Hamilton, and had teamed up at tennis with Leviton and brought Leviton the faculty doubles championship that had eluded him for 20 years. D. College, with an elite reputation and a middling endowment, depended for its survival on students whose parents could pay full tuition. To attract these students, the college had built a $30 million recreation center, 3 espresso bars, and a pair of hulking residence halls that were less like dorms than like vivid premonitions of the hotels in which the students would book rooms for themselves in their well-remunerated futures. There were herds of leather sofas and enough computers to ensure that no prospective matriculant or visiting parent could enter a room and not see at least one available keyboard, not even in the dining hall or field house. Junior faculty lived in semi-squalor. Chip was lucky to have a 2-story unit in a damp cinder-block development on Tilton Ledge Lane on the western edge of campus. His back patio overlooked a waterway known to college administrators as Kuiper's Creek and to everybody else as Carparts Creek. On the far side of the creek was a marshy automotive boneyard belonging to the Connecticut State Department of Corrections. The college had been suing in state and federal courts for 20 years to preserve this wetland from the eco-disaster of drainage and development as a medium-security prison. Every month or two, for as long as things were good with Ruthie, Chip invited colleagues and neighbors and the occasional precocious student to dinner at Tilton Ledge and surprised them with langoustines or a rack of lamb or venison with juniper berries and retro joke desserts like chocolate fondue. Sometimes late at night, presiding over a table on which empty Californian bottles were clustered like Manhattan high-rises, Chip felt safe enough to laugh at himself, open up a little, and tell embarrassing stories about his Midwestern childhood, like how his father not only had worked long hours at the Midland Pacific Railroad and read aloud to his children and done the yard work and home maintenance and processed a nightly briefcase full of executive paper, but had also found time to operate a serious metallurgical laboratory in the family basement, staying up past midnight to subject strange alloys to electrical and chemical stresses. And how Chip, at the age of 13, had developed a crush on the buttery alkali metals that his father kept immersed in kerosene, on the blushing crystalline cobalt, the buxom heavy mercury, the ground glass stopcocks and glacial acetic acid, and had put together his own junior lab in the shadow of his dad's. How his new interest in science had delighted Alfred and Enid, and how, with their encouragement, he'd set his young heart on winning a trophy at the regional St. Jude Science Fair. How, at the St. Jude City Library, he'd unearthed a plant physiology paper both obscure enough and simple enough to be mistaken for the work of a brilliant eighth grader. How he'd built a controlled plywood environment for growing oats and had photographed the young seedlings meticulously and then ignored them for weeks. And how, by the time he went to weigh the seedlings and determine the effects of gibberellic acid in concert with an unidentified chemical factor, the oats were dried out blackish slime. How he'd gone ahead anyway and plotted the experiment's correct results on graph paper, working backward to fabricate a list of seedling weights with some artful random scatter and then forward to make sure that the fictional data produced the correct results. And how, as a first-place winner at the science fair, he'd won a 3-foot-tall, silver-plated winged victory and the admiration of his father. And how, a year later, around the time his father was securing his first of 2 U.S. patents, despite his many grievances with Alfred, Chip was careful to impress on his dinner guests what a giant in his own way the old man was. Chip had pretended to study migratory bird populations in a park near some head shops and a bookstore and the house of a friend with foosball and a pool table. And how in a ravine at this park he'd uncovered a cache of down-market porn, over the weather-swollen pages of which, back home in the basement lab where, unlike his father, he never performed a real experiment or felt the faintest twinge of scientific curiosity, he'd endlessly dry-chafed the head of his erection without ever figuring out that this excruciating perpendicular stroke was actively suppressing orgasm. His dinner guests, many of them steeped in queer theory, took special delight in this detail. And how, as a reward for his mendacity and self-abuse and general laziness, he'd won a second winged victory. In the haze of dinner party smoke, as he entertained his sympathetic colleagues, Chip felt secure in the knowledge that his parents could not have been more wrong about who he was and what kind of career he was suited to pursue. For 2.5 years, until the fiasco of Thanksgiving in St. Jude, he had no troubles at D College. But then Ruthie dumped him, and a first-year female student rushed in, as it were, to fill the vacuum that Ruthie left behind. Melissa Paquette was the most gifted student in the intro theory course, consuming narratives, that he taught in his third spring at D. Melissa was a regal, theatrical person whom other students conspicuously avoided sitting close to, in part because they disliked her, and in part because she always sat in the first row of desks, right in front of Chip. She was long-necked and broad-shouldered, not exactly beautiful, more like physically splendid. Her hair was very straight and had the cherry wood color of new motor oil. She wore thrift store clothes that tended not to flatter her, a man's plaid polyester leisure suit, a paisley trapeze dress, gray Mr. Goodwrench coveralls with the name Randy embroidered on the left front pocket. Melissa had no patience with people she considered fools. At the second meeting of consuming narratives, when an affable dreadlocked boy named Chad — every class at D had at least one affable dreadlocked boy in it — took a stab at summarizing the theories of Thorstein Webern, Melissa began to smirk at Chip complicitly. She rolled her eyes and mouthed the word Veblen and clutched her hair. Soon Chip was paying more attention to her distress than to Chad's discourse.
"Chad, sorry," she interrupted finally. "The name is Veblen?"
"Webern, Veblern, that's what I'm saying."
"No, you were saying Webern. It's Veblen."
"Veblern, okay. Thank you very much, Melissa."
Melissa tossed her hair and faced Chip again, her mission accomplished. She paid no attention to the dirty looks that came her way from Chad's friends and sympathizers. But Chip drifted to a far corner of the classroom to dissociate himself from her, and he encouraged Chad to continue with his summary. That evening, outside the student cinema in Hillard Roth Hall, Melissa came pushing and squeezing through a crowd and told Chip that she was loving Walter Benjamin. She stood, he thought, too close to him. She stood too close to him at a reception for Marjorie Garber a few days later. She came galloping across the Lucent Technologies lawn, formerly the South Lawn, to press into his hands one of the weekly short papers that Consuming Narratives required. She materialized beside him in a parking lot that a foot of snow had buried, and with her mittened hands and considerable wingspan, she helped him dig out his car. She kicked a path clear with her fur-trimmed boots. She wouldn't stop chipping at the underlayer of ice on his windshield until he took hold of her wrist and removed the scraper from her hand. Chip had co-chaired the committee that drafted the college's stringent new policy on faculty-student contacts. Nothing in the policy prevented a student from helping a professor clear snow off his car. And since he was also sure of his self-discipline, he had nothing to be afraid of. And yet, before long, he was ducking out of sight whenever he saw Melissa on campus. He didn't want her to gallop over and stand too close to him, and when he caught himself wondering if the color of her hair was from a bottle, he made himself stop wondering. He never asked her if she was the one who'd left roses outside his office door on Valentine's Day, or the chocolate statuette of Michael Jackson on Easter weekend. In class, he called on Melissa slightly less often than he called on other students. He lavished particular attention on her nemesis, Chad. He sensed, without looking, that Melissa was nodding in comprehension and solidarity when he unpacked a difficult passage of Marcuse or Baudrillard. She generally ignored her classmates, except to turn on them in sudden, hot disagreement or cool correction. Her classmates, for their part, yawned audibly when she raised her hand. One warm Friday night, near the end of the semester, Chip came home from his weekly grocery run and discovered that someone had vandalized his front door. Three of the four utility lights at Tilton Ledge had burned out, and the college was apparently waiting for the fourth to burn out before investing in replacements. In the poor light, Chip could see that somebody had poked flowers and foliage, tulips, ivy, through the holes in his rotting screen door. "What is this?" he said. "Melissa, you are jail bait." Possibly he said other things before he realized that his stoop was strewn with torn-up tulips and ivy, a vandalism still in progress, and that he was not alone. The holly bush by his door had produced two giggling young people.
"Sorry, sorry," Melissa said. "You were talking to yourself."
Chip wanted to believe she hadn't heard what he said, but the holly wasn't 3 feet away. He set the groceries inside his house and turned a light on. Standing beside Melissa was the dreadlocked Chad.
"Professor Lambert, hello,"
Chad said earnestly. He was wearing Melissa's Mr. Goodwrench coveralls, and Melissa was wearing a free Mumia T-shirt that might have belonged to Chad.
She'd slung an arm around Chad's neck and fitted a hip over his. She was flushed and sweaty and lit up on something.
"We were decorating your door," she said.
"Actually, Melissa, it looks pretty horrible," Chad said as he examined it in the light. Beat-up tulips were hanging down at every angle. The ivy runners had clods of dirt in their hairy feet. "Kind of a stretch to say decorating."
"Well, you can't see down here," she said. "Where's the light?"
"There is no light," Chip said. "This is the ghetto in the woods. This is where your teachers live."
"Dude, that ivy is pathetic."
"Whose tulips are these?" Chip asked.
"College tulips," Melissa said.
"Dude, I'm not even sure why we were doing this." Chad turned to allow Melissa to put her mouth on his nose and suck it, which didn't seem to bother him, although he drew his head back.
"Wouldn't you say this was sort of more your idea than mine?" "Our tuition pays for these tulips," Melissa said, pivoting to press her body more frontally into Chad.
She hadn't looked at Chip since he turned the outdoor light on. "So then Hansel and Gretel came and found my screen door."
"We'll clean it up," Chad said.
"Leave it," Chip said. "I'll see you on Tuesday." And he went inside and shut the door and played some angry music from his college years. For the last meeting of Consuming Narratives, the weather turned hot. The sun was blazing in a pollen-filled sky. All the angiosperms in the newly rechristened Viacom Arboretum blooming hard. To Chip, the air felt disagreeably intimate, like a warm spot in a swimming pool. He'd already queued up the video player and lowered the classroom shades when Melissa and Chad strolled in and took seats in a rear corner. Chip reminded the class to sit up straight like active critics rather than be passive consumers, and the students sat up enough to acknowledge his request without actually complying with it. Melissa, usually the one fully upright critic, today slumped especially low and draped an arm across Chad's legs. To test his students' mastery of the critical perspectives to which he'd introduced them, Chip was showing a video of a 6-part ad campaign called You Go, Girl. The campaign was the work of an agency, Beat Psychology, that had also created Howl with Rage for G Electric, Do Me Dirty for C Jeans, Total Effing Anarchy for the W Network, Radical Psychedelic Underground for E.com, and Love and Work for M Pharmaceuticals. You Go Girl had had its first airing the previous fall, one episode per week on a primetime hospital drama. The style was black-and-white cinema verite. The content, according to analyses in the Times and the Wall Street Journal, was revolutionary. The plot was this. 4 women in a small office, one sweet young African-American, one middle-aged technophobic blonde, one tough and savvy beauty named Chelsea, and one radiantly benignant gray-haired boss, dish together and banter together and by, struggle together with Chelsea's stunning announcement at the end of episode 2 that for nearly a year she's had a lump in her breast that she's too scared to see a doctor about. In episode 3, the boss and the sweet young African-American dazzle the technophobic blonde by using the W Corporation's Global Desktop version 5.0 to get up-to-the-minute cancer information and to hook Chelsea into support networks and the very best local healthcare providers. The blonde, who is fast learning to love technology, marvels but objects. "There's no way Chelsea can afford all this." To which the angelic boss replies, "I'm paying every cent of it." By the middle of episode 5, however, and this was the campaign's revolutionary inspiration, it's clear that Chelsea will not survive her breast cancer. Tear-jerking scenes of brave jokes and tight hugs follow.
In the final episode, the action returns to the office, where the boss is scanning a snapshot of the departed Chelsea, and the now rabidly technophiliac blonde is expertly utilizing the W Corporation's global desktop version 5.0. And around the world, in rapid montage, women of all ages and races are smiling and dabbing away tears at the image of Chelsea on their own global desktops. Spectral Chelsea, in a digital video clip, pleads, "Help us fight for the cure." The episode ends with the information offered in a sober typeface that the W Corporation has given more than $10 million to the American Cancer Society to help it fight for the cure. The slick production values of a campaign like You Go Girl could seduce first-year students before they'd acquired the critical tools of resistance and analysis. Chip was curious and somewhat afraid to see how far his students had progressed. With the exception of Melissa, whose papers were written with force and clarity, none of them had persuaded him that they were doing more than parroting the weekly jargon. Each year, it seemed, the incoming freshmen were a little more resistant to hardcore theory than they'd been the year before. Each year, the moment of enlightenment, of critical mass, came a little later. Now the end of a semester was at hand, and Chip still wasn't sure that anyone besides Melissa really got how to criticize mass culture. The weather wasn't doing him any favors. He raised the shades and beach light poured into the classroom. Summer lust came wafting off the bared arms and legs of boys and girls alike. A petite young woman named Hilton, a chihuahua-like person, offered that it was brave and really interesting that Chelsea had died of cancer instead of surviving like you might have expected in a commercial. Chip waited for someone to observe that it was precisely this self-consciously revolutionary plot twist that had generated publicity for the ad. Normally, Melissa, from her seat in the front row, could be counted on to make a point like this, but today she was sitting by Chad with her cheek on her desk. Normally, when students napped in class, Chip called on them immediately. But today he was reluctant to say Melissa's name. He was afraid that his voice might shake. Finally, with a tight smile, he said, "In case any of you were visiting a different planet last fall, let's review what happened with these ads. Remember that Nielsen Media Research took the revolutionary step of giving Episode 6 its own weekly rating, the first rating ever given to an ad. And once Nielsen rated it, the campaign was all but guaranteed an enormous audience for its rebroadcast during the November sweeps. Also remember that the Nielsen rating followed a week of print and broadcast news coverage of the revolutionary plot twist of Chelsea's death, plus the internet rumor about Chelsea's being a real person who'd really died, which, incredibly, several hundred thousand people actually believed. Beat Psychology, remember, having fabricated her medical records and her personal history and posted them on the web. So my question for Hilton would be, how brave is it to engineer a surefire publicity coup for your ad campaign?"
"It was still a risk," Hilton said. "I mean, death is a downer. It could have backfired."
Again, Chip waited for someone, anyone, to take his side of the argument. No one did. "So a wholly cynical strategy," he said, "if there's a financial risk attached, becomes an act of artistic bravery?" A brigade of college lawnmowers descended on the lawn outside the classroom, smothering discussion in a blanket of noise. The sunshine was bright. Chip soldiered on. Did it seem realistic that a small business owner would spend her own money on special health care options for an employee? One student averred that the boss she'd had at her last summer job had been generous and totally great. Chad was silently fighting off the tickling hand of Melissa while, with his free hand, he counterattacked the naked skin of her midriff. "Chad," Chip said. Chad, impressively, was able to answer the question without having it repeated.
"Like, that was just one office," he said. "Maybe another boss wouldn't have been so great, but that boss was great.
I mean, nobody's pretending that's an average office, right?
Here Chip tried to raise the question of art's responsibilities vis-à-vis the typical. But this discussion, too, was DOA.
So, bottom line, he said, we like this campaign. We think these ads are good for the culture and good for the country, yes?
There were shrugs and nods in the sun-heated room.
Melissa, Chip said, we haven't heard from you.
Melissa raised her head from her desk, shifted her attention from Chad, and looked at Chip with narrowed eyes.
Yes, she said.
Yes what?
Yes, these ads are good for the culture and good for the country.
Chip took a deep breath, because this hurt.
Great, okay, he said. Thank you for your opinion.
As if you care about my opinion, Melissa said.
I beg your pardon?
As if you care about any of our opinions unless they're the same as yours.
This is not about opinions, Chip said. This is about learning to apply critical methods to textual artifacts, which is what I'm here to teach you.
I don't think it is, though, Melissa said. I think you're here to teach us to hate the same things you hate. I mean, you hate these ads, right? I can hear it in every word you say. You totally hate them.
The other students were listening raptly now. Melissa's connection with Chad might have depressed Chad's stock more than it had raised her own, but she was attacking Chip like an angry equal, not a student, and the class ate it up.
I do hate these ads, Chip admitted, but that's not...
Yes, it is, Melissa said. Why do you hate them? Chad called out. Tell us why you hate them,
the little Hilton yipped. Chip looked at the wall clock. There were 6 minutes left of the semester. He pushed a hand through his hair and cast his eyes around the room as if he might find an ally somewhere, but the students had him on the run now, and they knew it.
The W Corporation, he said, is currently defending 3 separate lawsuits for antitrust violations. Its revenues last year exceeded the gross domestic product of Italy. And now, to wring dollars out of the one demographic that it doesn't yet dominate, it's running a campaign that exploits a woman's fear of breast cancer and her sympathy with its victims. Yes, Melissa?
It's not cynical.
What is it if not cynical?
It's celebrating women in the workplace, Melissa said. It's raising money for cancer research. It's encouraging us to do our self-examinations and get the help we need. It's helping women feel like we own this technology, like it's not just a guy thing.
Okay, good, Chip said. But the question is not whether we care about breast cancer. It's what breast cancer has to do with selling office equipment.
Chad took up the cudgels for Melissa.
That's the whole point of the ad, though, that if you have access to information, it can save your life.
So if Pizza Hut puts a little sign about testicular self-exams by the hot pepper flakes, it can advertise itself as part of the glorious and courageous fight against cancer?
Why not?
Chad said. Does anybody see anything wrong with that?
Not one student did. Melissa was slouching with her arms crossed and unhappy amusement on her face. Unfairly or not, Chip felt as if she'd destroyed, in 5 minutes, a semester's worth of careful teaching.
"Well, consider," he said, "that You Go Girl would not have been produced if W had not had a product to sell. And consider that the goal of the people who work at W is to exercise their stock options and retire at 32, and that the goal of the people who own W stock..."
Chip's brother and sister-in-law, Gary and Caroline, owned a great deal of W stock.
"...is to build bigger houses and buy bigger SUVs and consume even more of the world's finite resources.
What's wrong with making a living? Melissa said. Why is it inherently evil to make money?
Baudrillard might argue, Chip said, that the evil of a campaign like You Go Girl consists in the detachment of the signifier from the signified. That a woman weeping no longer just signifies sadness, it now also signifies desire office equipment. It signifies our bosses care about us deeply.
The wall clock showed 2:30.
Chip paused and waited for the bell to ring and the semester to end.
"Excuse me," Melissa said, "but that is just such bullshit."
"What is bullshit?" Chip said.
"This whole class," she said. "It's just bullshit every week. It's one critic after another wringing their hands about the state of criticism. Nobody can ever quite say what's wrong exactly, but they all know it's evil. They all know corporate is a dirty word. And if somebody's having fun or getting rich, disgusting, evil. And it's always the death of this and the death of that. And people who think they're free aren't really free. And people who think they're happy aren't really happy. And it's impossible to radically critique society anymore. Although what's so radically wrong with society that we need such a radical critique? Nobody can say exactly. It is so typical and perfect that you hate those ads," she said to Chip as throughout Roth Hall bells finally rang. "Here things are getting better and better for women and people of color and gay men and lesbians, more and more integrated and open, and all you can think about is some stupid, lame problem with signifiers and signifieds. Like the only way you can make something bad out of an ad that's great for women, which you have to do because there has to be something wrong with everything, is to say it's evil to be rich and evil to work for a corporation. And yes, I know the bell rang." She closed her notebook.
"Okay," Chip said. "On that note, you've now satisfied your cultural studies core requirement. Have a great summer." He was powerless to keep the bitterness out of his voice. He bent over the video player and gave his attention to rewinding and re-cueing You Go Girl and touching buttons for the sake of touching buttons. He sensed a few students lingering behind him, as if they wanted to thank him for teaching his heart out or to tell him they'd enjoyed the class. But he didn't look up from the video player until the room was empty. Then he went home to Tilton Ledge and started drinking. Melissa's accusations had cut him to the quick. He'd never quite realized how seriously he'd taken his father's injunction to do work that was useful to society. Criticizing a sick culture, even if the criticism accomplished nothing, had always felt like useful work. But if the supposed sickness wasn't a sickness at all, if the great materialist order of technology and consumer appetite and medical science really was improving the lives of the formerly oppressed, if it was only straight white males like Chip who had a problem with this order, then there was no longer even the most abstract utility to his criticism. It was all, in Melissa's word, bullshit. Lacking the spirit to work on his new book, as he'd planned to do all summer, Chip bought an overpriced ticket to London and hitchhiked to Edinburgh and overstayed his welcome with a Scottish performance artist who had lectured and performed at D the previous winter. Eventually, the woman's boyfriend said, "Time to be off now, laddie." And Chip hit the road with a backpack full of Heidegger and Wittgenstein that he was too lonely to read. He hated to think of himself as a man who couldn't live without a woman. But he hadn't been laid since Ruthie dumped him. He was the only male professor in D history to have taught theory of feminism, and he understood how important it was for women not to equate success with having a man and failure with lacking a man. But he was a lonely, straight male. And a lonely, straight male had no equivalently forgiving theory of masculinism to help him out of this bind, this key to all misogynies. To feel as if he couldn't survive without a woman made a man feel weak. And yet, without a woman in his life, a man lost the sense of agency and difference that, for better or worse, was the foundation of his manhood. On many a morning in green Scottish places splashed with rain, Chip felt close to escaping this spurious bind and regaining a sense of self and purpose, only to find himself at 4 in the afternoon drinking beer at a train station, eating chips and mayonnaise, and hitting on Yankee college girls. As a seducer, he was hampered by ambivalence and by his lack of the Glaswegian accent that made American girls go weak in the knees. He scored exactly once, with a young hippie from Oregon
who had ketchup stains on her chemise and a scalpy smell so overpowering that he spent much of the night breathing through his mouth. His failures seemed more funny than squalid, though, when he came home to Connecticut and regaled his misfit friends with stories at his own expense. He wondered if somehow his Scottish depression had been the product of a greasy diet. His stomach heaved when he remembered the glistening wedges of browned whatever-fish, the glaucous arcs of lipidy chips, the smell of scalp and deep-fry, or even just the words, Firth of Forth. At the weekly farmer's market near D, he loaded up on heirloom tomatoes, white eggplants, and thin-skinned golden plums. He ate arugula, rocket, the old farmers called it, so strong it made his eyes water, like a paragraph of Thoreau. As he remembered the good and the healthful, he began to recover his self-discipline. He weaned himself off alcohol, got better sleep, drank less coffee, and went to the college gym twice a week. He read the damned Heidegger and did his crunches every morning. Other pieces of the self-improvement puzzle fell into place, and for a while, as cool working weather returned to the Carparts Creek Valley, he experienced an almost Thoreauvian well-being. Between sets on the tennis court, Jim Leviton assured him that his tenure review would be a mere formality, that he shouldn't worry about competing with the department's other young theorist, Vendla O'Fallon. Chip's fall course load consisted of Renaissance poetry and Shakespeare, neither of which required him to rethink his critical perspectives. As he girded himself for the last stage of his ascent of Mount Tenure, he was relieved to be traveling light, almost happy, after all, not to have a woman in his life. He was at home on a Friday in September, making himself a dinner of broccoli rabe and acorn squash and fresh haddock, and looking forward to a night of grading papers, when a pair of legs sashayed past his kitchen window. He knew this sashay. He knew the way Melissa walked. She couldn't pass a picket fence without trailing her fingertips against it. She stopped in hallways to do dance steps or hopscotch. She went backwards or sideways or skipped or loped. Her knock on his screen door was not apologetic. Through the screen, he saw that she had a plate of cupcakes with pink frosting. "Yeah, what's up?" he said. Melissa raised the plate on upturned palms.
"Cupcakes," she said. "Thought you might be needing some cupcakes in your life right around now."
Not being theatrical, Chip felt disadvantaged around people who were. "Why are you bringing me cupcakes?" he said. Melissa knelt and set the plate on his doormat among the pulverized remains of ivy and dead tulips.
"I'll just leave them here," she said. "And you can do whatever you want with them. Goodbye."
She spread her arms and pirouetted off the doorstep and ran up the flagstone path on tiptoe. Chip went back to wrestling with the haddock fillet, through the center of which ran a blood-brown fault of gristle that he was determined to cut out. But the fish had a starchy grain and was hard to get a grip on. "Fuck you, little girl," he said, as he threw the knife into the sink. The cupcakes were full of butter and frosted with a butter frosting. After he'd washed his hands and opened a bottle of Chardonnay, he ate four of them and put the uncooked fish in the refrigerator. The skins of the overbaked squash were like inner tube rubber, sentant de cinéma érotique, an edifying video that had sat on a shelf for months without making a peep, suddenly demanded his immediate and full attention. He lowered the blinds and drank the wine, and brought himself off again and again, and ate two more cupcakes, detecting peppermint in them, a faint buttery peppermint, before he slept. The next morning he was up at 7, and did 400 crunches. He immersed Sentant de Cinéma Érotique in dishwater, and rendered it, so to speak, non-combustible. He'd done this with many a pack of cigarettes while kicking the habit. He had no idea what he'd meant when he'd thrown the knife into the sink. His voice had sounded nothing like him. He went to his office in Roth Hall and graded papers. He wrote in a margin,
Cressida's character may inform Toyota's choice of product name. That Toyota's Cressida informs the Shakespearean text requires more argument than you present here. He added an exclamation point to soften his criticism. Sometimes, when ripping apart especially feeble student work, he drew smiley faces. Spell check, he exhorted a student who'd written Troilus for Troilus throughout her 8-page paper. And the ever-softening question mark beside the sentence, here Shakespeare proves Foucault all too right about the historicity of morals, Chip wrote, rephrase? Perhaps here the Shakespearean text seems almost to anticipate Foucault. Better Nietzsche? He was still grading papers 5 weeks later, 10 or 15,000 student errors later, on a windy night just after Halloween, when he heard a scrabbling outside his office door. Opening the door, he found a dime store trick-or-treat bag hanging from the hall side doorknob. The lever of this gift, Melissa Paquette, was backpedaling up the hall. "What are you doing?" he said.
"Just trying to be friends," she said.
"Well, thanks," he said. "I don't get it." Melissa came back down the hall. She was wearing white painter's overalls, a long-sleeve thermal undershirt, and hot pink socks.
"I went trick-or-treating," she said. "This was like one-fifth of my hall."
She stepped closer to Chip, and he backed away. She followed him into his office and circled it on tiptoe, reading titles on his shelves. Chip leaned against his desk and folded his arms tightly.
"So I'm taking theory of feminism with Wendler," Melissa said.
"That would be the logical next step. Now that you've rejected the nostalgic patriarchal tradition of critical theory."
"Exactly my thinking," Melissa said. "Unfortunately, her class is so bad. People who took it with you last year said it was great. But Wendler's idea is that we should sit around and talk about our feelings. Because the old theory was about the head, see? And therefore, the new true theory has to be about the heart. I'm not convinced she's even read all the stuff she assigns us."
Through his open door, Chip could see the door of Wendler O'Fallon's office. It was papered with healthful images and adages. Betty Friedan in 1965, beaming Guatemalan peasant women, a triumphant female soccer star, a Bass Ale poster of Virginia Woolf, subvert the dominant paradigm that reminded him in a dreary way of his old girlfriend, Tori Timmerman. His feeling about decorating doors was, what are we, high school kids? Are these our bedrooms? "So basically," he said, "even though you thought my class was bullshit, it now seems like a superior brand of bullshit because you're taking hers." Melissa blushed.
"Basically. Except you're a much better teacher. I mean, I learned a ton from you. That's what I wanted to tell you.
Consider me told."
"See, my mom and dad split up in April."
Melissa flung herself down on Chip's college-issue leather sofa and assumed the full therapeutic position.
"For a while it was kind of great that you were being so anti-corporate, and then suddenly it really, really irritated me. Like, my parents have a lot of money, and they're not evil people. Although my dad did just move in with this character named Vicky, who's like 4 years older than me, but he still loves my mom, I know he does. As soon as I was out of the house, things deteriorated a little. But I know he still loves her."
"The college has a lot of services," Chip said, arms folded, "for students going through these things."
"Thanks. On the whole, I'm doing brilliantly. Except for having been rude to you in class that time."
Melissa hooked her heels on the arm of the sofa, pried her shoes off, and let them drop to the floor. Soft curves in thermal knitwear spilled out to either side of her overalls bib, Chip noticed.
"I had an excellent childhood," she said. "My parents have always been my best friends. They homeschooled me till 7th grade. My mom was in med school in New Haven, and my dad had this punk band, the Nomadics, that was touring, and at my mom's first ever punk show she went out with my dad and ended up in his hotel room. She quit school, he quit the Nomadics, and they were never apart after that. Totally romantic. See, and my dad had some money from a trust fund, and it was really brilliant what they did then. There were all these new IPOs, and my mom was up on all the biotech and reading JAMA, and Tom, my dad, could vet the numbers part of it, and they just made really great investments. Claire, my mom, stayed home with me, and we hung out all day, you know, and I learned my times tables, etc., and it was always just the three of us. They were so in love. And parties every weekend. And finally it occurred to us, we know everybody, and we're really good investors, so why not start a mutual fund? Which we did. And it was incredible. It's still a great fund. It's called the West Portfolio Biofund 40. We started some other funds, too, when the climate got more competitive. You kind of have to offer a full array of services. That's what the institutional investors were telling Tom, at any rate. So he started these other funds, which unfortunately have pretty much tanked. I think that's the big problem between him and Claire. Because her fund, the Biofund 40, where she makes the picks, is still doing great. And now she's heartbroken and depressed. She's holed up in our house, and she never goes out. Meanwhile, Tom wants me to meet this Vicky person who he says is lots of fun and a rollerblader. The thing is, we all know my mom and dad are made for each other. They complement each other perfectly. And I just think if you knew how cool it is to start a company and how great it is when the money starts coming in and how romantic it can be, you wouldn't be so harsh.
Possibly, Chip said.
Anyway, I thought you'd be somebody I could talk to. On the whole, I'm coping brilliantly. But I could kind of use a friend.
How's Chad? Chip said.
A sweet boy. Good for about 3 weekends.
Melissa swung a leg off the sofa and planted a stockinged foot on Chip's leg, close to his hip.
It's hard to imagine two people less long-term compatible than him and me.
Through his jeans, Chip could feel the deliberate flexing of her toes. He was trapped against his desk, and so, to escape, he had to take hold of her ankle and swing her leg back onto the sofa. Her pink feet immediately grasped his wrist and pulled him toward her. It was all very playful, but his door was open, and his lights were on, and his blinds were raised, and somebody was in the hall.
"Code," he said, pulling free. "There's a code."
Melissa rolled off the sofa, stood up, and came closer.
"It's a stupid code," she said. "If you care about somebody."
Chip retreated to the doorway. Up the hall, by the department office, a tiny blue-uniformed woman with a Toltec face was vacuuming.
"There are good reasons to have it," he said.
"So I can't even give you a hug now?"
"That's right."
"It's stupid."
Melissa stepped into her shoes and joined Chip in the doorway. She kissed him on the cheek, near his ear.
"So there."
He watched her slide step and pirouette down the hall and out of sight. He heard a fire door bang shut. He carefully examined every word he'd said, and he gave himself an A for correctness. But when he returned to Tilton Ledge, where the last of the utility lights had burned out, he was swamped by loneliness. To erase the tactile memory of Melissa's kiss and her lively, warm feet, he phoned an old college friend in New York and made a date for lunch the next day. He took Cent Ans de cinéma érotique from the cabinet where, in expectation of a night like this, he'd stashed it after soaking it. The tape was still playable. The image was snowy, though, and during the first really hot bit, a hotel room scene with a wanton chambermaid, the snow thickened to a blizzard, and the screen went blue. The VCR made a dry, thin, choking sound. "Air! Need air!" it seemed to say. Tape had leaked out and wound itself around the machine's endoskeleton. Chip extracted the cassette and several handfuls of mylar, but then something broke and the machine spat up a plastic spool. Which, all right, these things happened. But the trip to Scotland had been a financial Waterloo, and he couldn't afford a new VCR. Nor was New York City on a cold, rainy Saturday the treat he needed.
Every sidewalk in Lower Manhattan was dotted with the metallic squared spirals of anti-theft badges. The badges were bonded to the wet pavement with the world's strongest glue, and after Chip had bought some imported cheeses, he did this every time he visited New York to be sure of accomplishing at least one thing before returning to Connecticut, and yet it felt a little sad to buy the same baby Gruyere and Fourme d'Ambert at the same store. It brought him up against the more general failure of consumerism as an approach to human happiness. And after he'd lunched with his college friend, who had recently quit teaching anthropology and hired himself out to Silicon Valley as a marketing psychologist, and who advised Chip now to wake up and do the same, he returned to his car and discovered that each of his plastic-wrapped cheeses was protected by its own anti-theft badge, and that, indeed, a fragment of anti-theft badge had stuck to the bottom of his left shoe. Tilton Ledge was glazed with ice and very dark. In the mail, Chip found an envelope containing a short note from Enid lamenting Alfred's moral failures.
"He sits in that chair all day, every day."
And a lengthy profile of Denise, clipped from Philadelphia Magazine, with a slavering review of her restaurant, Mare Scuro, and a full-page glamour photo of the young chef. Denise in the photo was wearing jeans and a tank top, and was all muscled shoulders and satiny pecs. "Very young and very good, Lambert in her kitchen," the caption read. And this was just the kind of girl-as-object horseshit, Chip thought bitterly, that sold magazines. A few years ago, Enid's letters had reliably contained a paragraph of despair about Denise and Denise's failing marriage, with phrases like, "He is too old for her," double underlined, and a paragraph festooned with thrills and prouds apropos of Chip's hiring by D. College, and although he knew that Enid was skilled at playing her children off against each other and that her praise was usually double-edged, he was dismayed that a woman as smart and principled as Denise had used her body for marketing purposes. He threw the clipping in the trash. He opened the Saturday half of the Sunday Times and... yes, he was contradicting himself. Yes, he was aware of this. Paged through the magazine in search of ads for lingerie or swimwear to rest his weary eyes on. Finding none, he began to read the book review, where a memoir called Daddy's Girl by Vendla O'Fallon was declared astonishing and courageous and deeply satisfying on page 11. The name Vendla O'Fallon was rather unusual, but Chip had been so completely unaware that Vendla was publishing a book that he refused to believe she'd written Daddy's Girl until, near the end of the review, he encountered a sentence that began, "O'Fallon, who teaches at D. College." He closed the book review and opened a bottle. In theory, both he and Vendla were in line for tenure in textual artifacts, but in practice the department was already over-tenured. That Vendla commuted to work from New York, thus flouting the college's informal requirement that faculty live in town, and that she skipped important meetings and taught every gut she could had been steady sources of comfort to Chip. He still had the edge in scholarly publications, student evaluations, and support from Jim Leviton. But he found that two glasses of wine had no effect on him. He was pouring himself his fourth when his telephone rang. It was Jim Leviton's wife, Jackie.
"I just wanted you to know," Jackie said, "that Jim's going to be okay."
"Was something wrong?" Chip said.
"Well, he's resting fine. We're over at St. Mary's."
"What happened?"
"Chip, I asked him if he thought he could play tennis, and you know what? He nodded. I said I was going to call you, and he nodded yes, he was good for tennis. His motor skills appear to be fully normal. Fully normal. And he's lucid. That's the important thing. That is the really good news here, Chip. His eyes are bright. He's the same old Jim."
"Jackie, did he have a stroke?"
"There'll be some rehabilitation," Jackie said. "Obviously today will be his effective retirement date, which, Chip, as far as I'm concerned, is an absolute blessing. We can make some changes now, and in 3 years, well, it's not going to take any 3 years for him to rehabilitate. When all is said and done, we're going to be ahead of this game. His eyes are so bright, Chip. He's the same old Jim."
Chip rested his forehead against his kitchen window.
and turned his head so that he could open one eye directly against the cold, damp glass. He knew what he was going to do.
"The same old, lovable Jim," Jackie said.
The following Thursday, Chip made dinner for Melissa and had sex with her on his red chaise longue. He'd taken a fancy to the chaise back in the days when dropping $800 on an antique store impulse was somewhat less suicidal financially. The chaise's backrest was angled in erotic invitation, its padded shoulders thrown back, its spine arching. The plush of its chest and belly looked ready to burst the fabric buttons that crisscrossed it. Breaking his initial clinch with Melissa, Chip excused himself for one second to turn off lights in the kitchen and stop in the bathroom. When he returned to the living room, he found her stretched out on the chaise wearing only the pants half of her plaid polyester leisure suit. In the dim light, she could have been a hairless, heavy-titted man. Chip, who much preferred queer theory to queer practice, basically hated the suit and wished she hadn't worn it. Even after she'd taken off the pants, there was a residue of gender confusion on her body, not to mention the rank B.O. that was the bane of synthetic fabrics. But from her underpants, which to his relief were delicate and sheer, distinctly gendered, an affectionate, warm rabbit came springing, a kicking, wet, autonomous, warm animal. It was almost more than he could handle. He hadn't slept 2 hours in the previous two nights, and he had a head full of wine and a gut full of gas. He couldn't remember why he'd made a cassoulet for dinner, possibly for no good reason. And he worried that he hadn't locked the front door, that there was a gap in the blinds somewhere, that one of his neighbors would drop by and try the door and find it unlocked, or peer in through the window and see him flagrantly violating sections 1, 2, and 6 of a code that he himself had helped draft. Altogether for him it was a night of anxiety and effortful concentration, punctuated by little stabs of throttled pleasure. But at least Melissa seemed to find it exciting and romantic. Hour after hour, she wore a big, crinkled U of a smile. It was Chip's proposal, after a second extremely stressful tryst at Tilton Ledge, that he and Melissa leave campus for the week-long Thanksgiving break and find a cottage on Cape Cod where they wouldn't feel observed and judged. And it was Melissa's proposal, as they departed through Dee's little-used eastern gate under cover of darkness, that they stop in Middletown and buy drugs from a high school friend of hers at Wesleyan. Chip waited in front of Wesleyan's impressively weatherproofed ecology house and drummed on the steering wheel of his Nissan, drummed so hard his fingers throbbed because it was important not to think about what he was doing. He'd left behind mountains of ungraded papers and exams, and he had not yet managed to visit Jim Levitt